Escalante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day at the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and about 15 into hour two, and I have got an additional guest that is going to join us. I'm going to think it's in hour three. Chris Hyde, Animal Lobbyists. Chris is going to join us. He's got news regarding the SAFE Act and the next step in the process. So we'll get an update on that. And it's funny that Chris just sent me a note, and yesterday, as I was kind of, you know, figuring out what is left to do here the next 3 days before we take the 10-day break, and that was one of the things I thought about, that I said, I wonder what's happening, because I hadn't heard from him in a couple of weeks. So you're going to get an update about what's happening when it comes to the SAFE Act. Deshaun Parker is, I think Deshaun's joining us, and he's, whenever I call you, it's because you've done something spectacular. Congratulations, Deshaun, on win number 6,000.
Hey, Steve, I really appreciate it, man. I like getting a call from you. That means I'm doing things right.
you've been doing things right for a long, long time, and it's funny because it just doesn't feel that long ago that we talked when you hit 5,000, and there was that night when you won. What'd you win? Five stakes that one night? Four stakes? Whatever it was.
Four stakes. Yeah. I tell you, I've been lucky. I've done a lot of things in my career right now that I never ever thought I would get to. So I mean, knock on wood, I've been blessed.
Talk about what goes into that, Deshaun, because we talk every week with Tony Black, who, you know, you passed a while ago, and Rich Migliori. I mean, between the two of them, they won 10,000 races. You're in the low 20s now, and you've got some, you know, very big names in sight. You're going to pass Johnny Longden probably in the next, you know, 4 weeks or so. Talk about the longevity, talk about staying healthy, and some of those things you just kind of referred to.
That's the main thing, is basically staying healthy, you know. But the desire and the will is always going to be there. But, you know, sometimes we're not, you know, we're unfortunate that we're in a game that you do have injuries. So, you know, having a great season and a safe season is the main thing. And like I said, I mean, it's just I've always had that, you know, drive to just win races. I don't know what it is about me, but I mean, a lot of jockeys are that way too. So I know it's just not me, but I mean, I guess it's just built into us that we just want to win. And, you know, everybody says, oh man, you know, when you think you're going to hang it up, I keep telling everybody, I think it's, you know, when I stop winning races, but it's too fun right now. So I can't, I'm enjoying every day and everything like that. So I can't, you know, Who can say that they go to their job and love what they do? So, I mean, that's me.
When you started out And this is interesting because when you think about what Mike Smith is doing and John Velasquez and you know and any of the guys that are you know that are in the 50s essentially, then there's Perry Utes who's not human. You know,
sure.
when you started out though, how long did you anticipate your career might be?
To be honest, I anticipated my career probably to be riding that first day I rode because it was just something that me and my dad talked about when I was growing up. I mean, I always said I wanted to do it, and I always figured, you know, I was going to be too tall. So he said, hey, just go ahead and, you know, try it and get it out your system. And it's been riding. I've been riding ever since then. But, I mean, like I said, just when I first started, it was just basically to just go out there and get it out of my system and say I did it. Never thought I'd, you know, be where I'm at today.
Amazing. And then as, you know, you're 50, what, 50?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, here you are, and one thing that certainly that Mig and Tony talk about, and we hear from Mike Smith and from Johnny, I mean, when you think about Johnny Velasquez, it seemed to people maybe 5-6 years ago, after a couple of major injuries, people thought, well, Johnny's, you know, the career's winding down and Johnny's probably going to, and instead he's had this resurgence. And everybody that gets into this range, one of the things that seems to be a common, you know, common theme is that the nutrition, the physical, you know, taking care of yourself physically, it I don't know if it got easier, but it seemed like those of you that are going into their 40s and 50s, you recognized at a certain point that if I stay fit and I stay healthy, I can keep doing this. And let's face it, you make good money. I mean, it's a hell of a career. It's a great livelihood.
Oh, it definitely is. And like you just said, I mean, I think for some reason it feels like, you know, the older you get, I mean, it's not like it's harder to stay fit because I think you stay fit for so long all the time because you're always riding and stuff like that, and it just makes you feel better. And then, you know, a lot of people, you know, I guess I know Johnny, I know Johnny and Mike Smith, they love the game so much that they're just going to continue trying to do whatever they can to stay fit and stay in the game because, you know, like I said, when you're out there winning races, it doesn't matter where you're at or, you know, what kind of race it is, a win's a win. And it's just so, you know, such a thrill that we just can't give it up right now. So, I mean, me, myself, you know, and I mean, like I said, I fitness-wise, I feel like it's gotten a lot easier for me, you know, now than, you know, when I was younger trying to ride, you know, and trying to lose a lot of weight and everything. I never really had to lose a lot of weight, but still losing weight, you know, and everything. It seems like a weight, you know, pretty much natural now, and it's, you know, a lot easier.
Unbelievable. And, you know, one thing, when I said to everybody that you were going to join us, one thing that has changed in the time that you know, you've come on with me over the years, you're in a little bit more of a public eye, Deshaun. And talk about the satisfaction, you know, not that riding in West Virginia, you know, as you said, a win's a win, and the money was very good and so forth. But you've become much more visible, I think, to a wider audience of horse players and stakeholders that have become much more aware of how good a rider you are and have been for so long.
Yeah, you know, I got a great opportunity. And like I said, West Virginia was always great to me and always will be home and, you know, a great racetrack for me because, it, you know, that's where my career started and it boosted my career. But I got lucky to, you know, be able to venture out and go to different tracks and everything. And once I got to those different tracks, I really felt appreciated and everything and felt like, you know, everybody that was, you know, there, all the trainers and owners and stuff like that still gave me a great shot to ride horses for them. And I was just telling Brett Calhoun that, you know, today, you know, it's like every racetrack that I've been to, every different racetrack that I've been to that Brett's been at, he's always gave me a chance to ride his horses, and I really appreciate that, you know. And, I mean, that's a lot of trainers that do that. But, I mean, like I said, I think just, you know, working hard, winning races is, you know, going to, in anybody's eyes, the trainers and owners, if you're winning, they want to ride you. So that's what, you know, that's my goal, to just keep winning and keep getting the rides.
This came up with Tony a couple of weeks ago, and one of the benefits of riding in West Virginia was that you had, you know, ostensibly a year-round, you know, the chance to ride at one place year-round and not have to make the move and, you know, and move around to on a circuit or let's say Mid-American racing. I mean, in recent years with Sam Houston and some Turfway and folding in Indiana, that's a different lifestyle. You know, talk about the pros and cons of making that kind of a transition.
Oh, you're definitely right about that. I mean, you know, when I was in West Virginia, I was home every night, and, you know, like it was year-round racing, so it wasn't, you know, that big of a move. Nowadays, I'm probably home. I think last year I probably was home maybe a whole month out of the year, pretty much, you know, month or month and a half. So, I mean, it's definitely a difference. But, I mean, for me, just being out there riding with a lot of great riders and, you know, different riders, I kind of like that, and it just makes you, you know, see a lot of different places and see a lot of different tracks, and, you know, to be able to win races at those tracks and everything like that is, a good thing too. And it's a hard life to live on the road, but it's really a great life too. So, I mean, you could take it either way. And the one good thing that I have, my kids are older now, so it's not like, you know, I have to be there all the time for them and everything like that. So, I mean, that made it a lot easier too.
In terms of goals and you talk about motivation and just having a desire to win, so that's sort of the foundation. What is out there that you'd still like to do?
Well, I definitely want to, you know, win some greater races and stuff like that and ride in some bigger races. I mean, that's definitely a goal of mine. But the main goal is just to basically stay healthy and keep winning.
You know, you won the Wolf Award last year or the year before?
Last year. It would be last year now, yeah, last year.
There you go. That's an award that riders covet. It's something that's voted on by, you know, your fellow riding community. The other kinds of laurels. You're an interesting person to ask this of. When you saw Sonny Leone win the Derby, Deshaun, that's got to be for riders who operate on regional circuits. I'm going to guess, and I haven't asked anybody this, but I imagine it's got to be so gratifying to see that happen and to think to yourself, why is that not me next year?
Oh, definitely. You know, I was so proud to see Sonny win that race. And not only that, actually the first year I went to Sam Houston, I rode everything for Eric Reed. He's the one who took me to Sam Houston. So I was, you know, extremely happy to hear, you know, see him win the race too. So, I mean, but yes, I tell everybody this, hey, all the jockeys are the same. We put our pants on one leg at a time. And if we have horse underneath us, we're going to get it done. So, I mean, no matter what kind of race it is, you just have to have the horse. I mean, all riders can ride. You just need that horse underneath you to get you to the wire, you know.
Well,
but, yeah, I was definitely proud. I was definitely happy to see Sonny.
I figured that, and I didn't know that about you and Eric, that he got you to make that move.
Yeah, my old agent Billy Johnson, who passed away a couple years ago, he was good friends with Eric. I mean, I had always ridden for Eric at Mountaineer too. So I mean, you know, but when Eric was talking about making a move for the wintertime to Sam Houston, he asked us to go, and we went with him, and we had a great meet that year too.
Who's handling your book right now?
Jimmy McNerney.
Oh, there you go, Jimmy McNerney, the do-it-all, the ultra versatile Jimmy McNerney.
Jimmy Mac, I tell you what, he can do it all, and he knows everybody. That's one good thing about him.
Well, and you know, maybe you can tell him that you're gonna you're maybe going to jump into the announcer's booth, follow him into that down the road.
I tell you, that's one thing you say, Fat, because I don't know if I could do that.
You know, Deshaun, I don't know if I should. I don't want to get you upset or me upset. I lost my father in the last 2 weeks, and had a Father's Day that was kind of bittersweet, and I know at the time. In fact, I think you came on and we talked about your dad's passing, and I mean, it had an extended career in the industry and widely respected official, and I know, you know, instrumental in you know, your everyday on the racetrack. Your dad's got to be with you.
Oh, for sure. You know, I mean, that's why yesterday was so special too. I mean, just, you know, my dad's always been an inspiration in my life and my career. So, I mean, he's always, you know, held me down, and whenever things are going bad and everything, he gave me that word that I need to hear, you know, just relax and everything, it'll come and stuff like that. So, I mean, you always want him to be physically there, but I mean, I know he's there with me no matter what. So I mean, it was definitely hard, but you know, I my dad was, you know, everything to me. So I mean, like you said, you just lost your dad, so you know how it is. I mean, it's one of those things that we'll never get over, but we gotta, you know, live with and understand that it's part of life. So, you know, I mean, I guess they're in a better place, and that's all we can, you know, be happy for, and you know that they with us, and the time that we had with them was a great time. So,
well, the widespread respect and appreciation that you have industry wide, and another big milestone with plenty more to come. To be honest, I mean, there's no reason, you know, you're winning 125 to 150 races a year, so there's some other big names to pass. Seems to me you're a ways away from thinking about retiring even.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be a Perry, but I'm going to try to keep it going as long as I can. You know, my hat's off to Perry. He's something else. He's amazing.
Well, the 6,000th win, and when number 5999 came earlier on the card, it became pretty obvious that the next one was coming, because you were going to be, well, that horse was like 2-5, I think, right? For Mama, and actually you got extended by Sammy Bermudez.
Oh yeah, the first race I rode, I thought I had it, and Sammy come and nailed me on the outside. I was like, man. And then the next race, I ended up got lucky and won that race. And then for the 6,000 race, I finally, you know, I was waiting for a hold the whole race and everything, so I finally got that hold. Next thing I look over and I see Sammy Bermudez coming up the rail, and I was like, not again. You know, I thought he's gonna nail me again at the water. Yeah, but it was, I mean, it was
Deshaun
a pretty fun
Parker.
Time.
Delighted, always, and you know, completely deserving of all the accolades and the recognition and the appreciation of players and fans and industry participants. Deshaun, stay safe. Congratulations, many, many more.
Steve, I definitely appreciate it. Hopefully, you'll be calling me soon for something else, because I like hearing you, getting your phone calls.
that graded stake win. We got to tick that box. Plenty of graded stake placements. We got to get you the GSW to go along with everything else that you've accomplished and continue to accomplish. Deshaun Parker, everybody, and you follow Deshaun on Twitter, Jock Deshaun, DeshaWn Deshaun Parker. Good luck tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
There we go, Deshaun Parker. I love it. And Tonight he's just looking down. Let's see. In fact, because it came up earlier, he's got acutely in the first of the two stakes, the filly race, and then he's got then he's on who did Papa say? Pickle Feet, the 12. But he's got a full complement of rides to Sean Parker. All right, Eric Hamelbeck is joining us next. And, in fact, he just texted me. We'll get him on. Yeah, Case, go ahead and get, Eric in here, and then Seth Merrill later, Chris Hyde, and Todd Pletcher. Plenty to do yet. And I did get the word from Andrew Offerman. Noon is scratch time. 11 a.m. Central is scratch time at Canterbury. And he said, look for the scratches by 12:30 Eastern, 11:30 Central. All right. So that's good, actually. And that still is a good, you know, 6 hours ahead of first post. First post, 6:45. I take that back. 6:10. 6:10. I was looking at Indy. Indy's first post is 6:45 Eastern. So Canterbury will start first. And if you missed the Eric Hallstrom visit, the way Indy is going to handle things, for instance, they don't get close. The two cards don't start to merge until race four at Canterbury at 7:41. And Indy is at 7:45. Then they get a little closer. Race five at Canterbury is 7:12. And it's 7:12 Eastern, Central. So that's 8:12 Eastern, 8:15 Eastern for Indy. So Indy will move back a little further. At that point, essentially, they'll let Canterbury run. So, for instance, race six will go off at 8:43, the Lady Canterbury. And instead of going, expect 8:48 maybe. And they will keep running from that point after the Canterbury races. All right? So don't expect those, don't be up in arms that why isn't Indy going off at their scheduled times? They're doing it to help everybody, to help Canterbury and help all of us as players. Trying to help all the horsemen out there is Eric Hamelbeck, and I'll say the same thing, Eric, that I said to you at Oaklawn for the HBPA convention. I know that you're not the kind of person that would say, I warned you, but indeed, the National HBA was trying to blow a whistle here and say time out, and we're going too fast. You're not, when it came to HISA, this is a slow moving train wreck. And frankly, they're not doing a lot to make it easier on anybody. I think you tuned in yesterday and listened to the five horsemen present their individual opinions. I wanted you to kind of follow up and discuss what you brought up in the meeting Monday and basically present the current case and what the National HBPA wants people to be aware of with us 10 days away from this HISA going into effect.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and really appreciated all of the group that spoke yesterday about the meeting from Monday, including my good buddy Chuck. You know, I mean, that I thought he had some color and flair that really kind of brought it all together. So thanks for getting them on. And I texted each one of them afterwards and actually ended up speaking to Ron. So I'm very pleased with their presentation of how the meeting went. So, yes, I consider myself an extremely humble person. I'm working very hard for all of these horsemen to get things right. You know, I know how we get labeled and certainly how I get attacked personally and the organization personally, but the lawsuits are based around constitutionality, not Lasix. And that's very important. And there's a lot of aspects that go into unconstitutionality, and it was embarrassing to see some of the major writers actually say, I'll paraphrase, find 10 horsemen that can tell me what unconstitutionality even means. You know, that's embarrassing. That's rung true to me for quite a while. But ultimately, I still say, and I said at the meeting, the National HVPA has been for uniform standards long before I got into the seat that I'm in now, based on science, based on practicality, and put together by the people in the industry. You know, and we're lacking several of those points in the way this uniformity is being rolled out. And yes, I do smile a little bit now, and my new phrase is, I keep putting a brick on my I told you so wall, because I tried to warn you, I tried to warn a lot of folks, and again, we want uniformity as much as the jockey club, but the way this is rolling out has been, and so far is proving to be, a bit of a fiasco, and has certainly caused chaos within the industry.
Point by point, I guess, and maybe you want to do it on a priority basis, and some of this, I'm sure, are areas that came up yesterday. But essentially, Eric, start wherever you want that you know you feel are the biggest issues, and whether they were ones that were established already, you know, before the specifics came down, or whether they're things that have cropped up. Give everybody a feel for what the National HBPA is most concerned about, and we'll take them one by one and you know, kind of kick them around.
Perfect. I'm going to start with one that I would say is a moot point now, Steve, and that's poor communication. You know, you and I have had offline conversations about what's going on, why have we not heard, when are the rules posted. You know, we had a group in the room on Monday that now knows the anti-doping medication control program is on the website with HISA. Have you ever seen that really put out there in the press? And oh, by the way, the comment period closes at the end of the month. You know, I can go all the way back to February of 2021 when the nominating committee was announced, and I actually made a suggestion to two of the nominating committee members, well, you really ought to consider getting someone focused on nothing but communication, because where my office is, at the training center on Paris Pike in Lexington, literally people beating on my window to find out what's going on and what's going to be the next step. So since then, it really hasn't gotten better. And I'm going to acknowledge, and I continue to acknowledge, they've got a tough task. There's no doubt about it. I think they have probably a limited staff of people and the logistics that they're trying to do. But they damn sure should have put somebody in charge of communication and getting the word out there. Because when you look at when they rolled out registration alone, boy, that should have been done a lot sooner. Maybe some of the glitches could have been worked out when we're looking at, what, now 9 days away, and we still don't have people registered, and we still have the glitches in the system. So poor communication is something that I'm still frustrated at, but, you know, that ship sailed. Nothing I can do about it at this point. The other situation that is old, and that's the funding. I mean, Steve, how many times have I been on your show since 2015 saying, where's the money going to come from? How much is this going to cost? And I actually gave a very true story at the meeting on Monday. The very first person that I was close to in the industry that said that was Dr. David Richardson. He asked the group that presented at the TOBA trustees when I was still on the board, how is this going to be funded? And that resonated with me, and it still has, and we still don't know at least what the anti-doping and medication control aspect of the act is going to cost us. And, you know, combined with the almost $14.4 million budget that they, being the HISA authority, rolled out earlier this summer, we still just don't know. So that's frustrating. You know, I mean, where are we going to go from here shouldn't be a question we're asking, you know, just a handful of days before the first portion of this act comes into play.
Complete, you know, complete agreement. You know, in fact, it's interesting. Chuck, in his summary yesterday, one of the things that he mentioned, which is really kind of, I won't say fallen by the wayside, but you talk about our conversations over the years, and also the ones with Alan Foreman, the ongoing alert, Eric, that we tried to communicate, that this system, that the horse players and the owners are already the ones that are paying the freight with horse players and owners, and
right.
adding another layer of burden to them, it was going to be onerous. And so for the longest time, every version of what ended up becoming HISA, every version included in it that increases in takeout were not going to be acceptable. We're not going to be able to utilize takeout increases as a way to fund right. this. And then, lo and behold, when the actual HISA gets grafted onto the omnibus bill, that's been removed. And suddenly, right. you know, obviously on the table. And so surcharges and, you know, so many other whispers and you know suggestions we'll see, but it sure feels like owners and horse players are going to end up being the ones that have to pay for this. And it's quite something that one group that has seemingly been in the position to fund this and contribute considerably, and I know, yes, they've helped with the startup, they've helped pay for the startup, but where's the Jockey Club's funding portion of this? Has that been right. discussed openly?
I would say openly, maybe not in print, but certainly, yes. You know, the breed registry is there for a reason. The breed registry is set to protect the breed overall. Certainly haven't seen them announce any additions to registering a thoroughbred who will be a covered horse or is intended to be a covered horse so that ultimately the breeders can pay for some of this too. No, they haven't made any mention of that. Boy, that'd be an awfully good thing to do for goodwill right now, because as we continue to see, there's a lot of especially trainers, but owners and trainers who have a concern that there is no covering of younger horses, right? So, you know, I've always been on a soapbox about being able to protect the consumer, right? Utilizing a Consumer Protection Act, we need to look at horses that are sold publicly. And I think this was an opportunity that was missed to be able to govern some of that. Again, from the two-year-old sales down to the yearling sales, even the weanling sales, I would love to see one of those horses in those categories pass a post-race sample. I venture to say the vast majority couldn't. Again, I'm not talking about nefarious actions, but I am talking about medicating horses to get them through the ring. And now, with the way the program appears to be going, you know, all of that's out the window. So, you know, possibly the breeders could have helped fund this if there were additional amendments that could increase the percentage of possibly registering a horse. Again, now breeders are going to be mad at me, but at the end of the day, these horses are being produced to become covered horses, but at this point, there's no mechanism that, and I know plenty of breeders that are owners, so I'm not saying that it's not going to happen, but at the end of the day, there are some other mechanisms that could help with the funding process. But let me just move
on that topic.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I want to add. I want to add one thing, and then because I know you got. I'm sure you got three, four more things on the covered horse topic, and on the sales marketing and the marketplace. Full surgeries, corrective surgeries. Disclosure.
Right.
We're worried about MagnaWave, but there's nothing about there's nothing about full surgeries.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, I've always kind of, I guess, gone back and forth with people who, again, I'm a pro Lasix administration on race day person. I admit that. I believe it's useful for the horse and in the best interest of the horse. But can you tell me that a transphyseal screw or a transphyseal bridge or a periosteal stripping, can you tell me that that's not performance enhancing? If you want to label Lasix as performance enhancing, absolutely not. I mean, to me, it's not even in the same category. You're changing the genetic makeup of a horse, well, the conformational genetics, by artificially adding a surgical procedure that will change the conformation of a horse. Now, I know that letters are submitted into the sales, right? So, but where is that horse down the road, and when does that information actually get to the trainer? Possibly never. So, yes, I'm a big proponent of if you want to talk about Lasix as performance enhancing, then we need to start adding these corrective surgeries into that category. And, you know, the best medication out there for epiphysitis is Winstrol. And that's become, you know, unheard of on the racetrack for good reasons. We quickly banned anabolic steroids because it was the best thing for the industry, and we all knew it. But at the end of the day, if you have a weanling with horrible epiphysitis, that's something that can help. Is that now going to be penalized when the trainer gets it 2 or 3 years later and that horse has a hair sample that Winstrol comes up? That's a possibility in the future with the way things are going. So again, you know, that to me is that's a very gray area that really shouldn't be gray. That needs to be painted more into the black and white picture of control if this is the way we're going to do it in the best interest of the horse. So, but yeah, I really want to jump into some other points, but you tell me where to go. I was going to jump into the kind of registration process.
Go ahead.
Okay. I know that there's a lot of concern about registration with HISA, with the authority. And I'm going to first say, and I always try to open up and acknowledge, we understand that this bill was signed into law. We understand it's the law until the courts say otherwise. But I do also want everyone to understand that the registration itself does have some concerns. There are some concerns that have floated around on social media that I think are a bit exacerbated. You know, the search and seizure aspect, there are many of the same qualifications within a state racing license that you're signing up for, so to speak. But if you choose to register, you are agreeing to the authority's rules. Now, I'm going to first point out that the authority's rules have not all been approved yet, right? So we don't know the anti-doping and medication control rules, but as soon as you sign up, you are agreeing to that point. Regarding the search and seizure aspect, I acknowledge the fact that the authority members are trying to amend that, and the lawyer term is narrow the scope of that search and seizure wording. But that amended wording is not in the FTC, and it's certainly not on the Federal Register. And the other aspect of registration that I just want to make a fact, and Lisa Lazarus confirmed it on Monday, the registration rule in and of itself has not been approved by the FTC. So, again, they certainly make it well known that if you enter a horse on July 1st, although there are some grace aspects, your horse is going to be scratched if you, your owner, and the horse are not registered. That is what they are saying. I will, I guess you could say, Steve, I'm going to acknowledge that, but I'm going to go then next to my program effective date, which is July 1st. Now, you know, we've asked that question several times, you know, has the FTC approved the registration rule? And I'll be honest, they could have approved it last night, and I might not know it, but the last time I've looked, it's still not approved. And you've got authority staff members now on all these Zoom calls. One blatantly lied to the group in Indiana on a Zoom call when they were asked directly, had the registration rule been approved by the FTC? And they authoritatively said yes. Well, I knew the answer was no. And it's sad to think that I know a few more details about all of this process than they do. So if you look at the program effective date, that date is July 1st. And admittedly, they are trying to get people to sign up before the program effective date. The rule's not approved, and the program effective date has not come yet. But they want people to register early. So I'm just giving you the facts for your listeners to hear. Feel free to call me and discuss it further. We're not telling people not to register, and we're certainly helping. I did agree to help the authority disseminate the information on how to register, and I would say that I get probably half the number of calls, but certainly a lot of calls about questions because they can't get them answered from the authority. And granted, they're overwhelmed. I get it. But the rule's not been approved, and the program effective date is not here yet. So I think that's a concern, and I think your listeners and my horsemen need to be aware of that, and I've tried to make that very clear. But the ramifications are, as they say they are, your horse will be scratched if you're not registered after July, or I should say scratched from a race after July 1st. So we'll see how that goes and what process that takes. But all of that I'm going to kind of sum up to say that what we've really been advocating for, Steve, and we think this is a fair ask, and that is a delay. I've said, even as you know, yesterday on a call with a senator, that you know I take my HBPA hat off right now with this ask, because it's obvious, even from some casual, somewhat jovial comments from the authority staff members, including Ms. Lazarus herself. You know, I wish we had more time. I wish we had more time to get these rules done, but we have to get it done by July 1st. That's been their message. Congress gave us July 1st. Well, I'll ask your audience, just like I asked Monday, if they move the anti-doping and medication control program away from January 1st, of July 1st, they moved it to January 2024, or 3, then they move the crop rule, then they move the shoe rule. Tell me why they can't move the entire process back. Now, Ms. Lazarus said Monday, when I asked her point blank, who gave the authority permission to move out of the program effective date with the anti-doping and medication control program? She said the FTC. Now, I'll ask again, just like I asked her Monday, please show me that proof. I'm willing to be wrong, but I feel very confident that is not the case. The arbitrary movement of that date was done by the authority. The moving of the shoe and the crop rule was done by the authority. My only point to say that, Steve, for all the listeners out there, is that should be justification enough to see we can move this back. We need to move this back. If this is going to be the law, we've waited for all these years, they say, to get uniformity. Why are we going to roll something out that isn't ready to go? That doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help horsemen. It doesn't help owners. It doesn't help horse players. If we're going to do this, then we, by God, need to get it right. And it seems very obvious, even on a logistical stage, this isn't ready to go. And they can move it back. So I've been working very hard with our team to try to just convince members of Congress that this needs to be delayed in the best interest of the industry. And I've certainly given them enough examples that I feel are justifiable to make that decision.
I guess, you know, asking names specifically, I when you mentioned a senator, you would think that this is something that if a Mitch McConnell asked or inquired, could make happen?
Without question, I think if Senator McConnell himself asked for it, it would happen. I would say that at this point, Senator McConnell's office has not been open or receptive to that ask. So we are talking to both sides of Congress. Yesterday happened to be a Senate call, but there are certainly members that are hearing what's going on. They're getting a lot of messages from their constituents that there are problems, and they are looking to get some answers from the authority. They want to know. I mean, I've asked them the same question. Did you, Mr. Federal Representative, give them permission to move the date back? Mrs. Federal Representative, did you allow them to change this date? And the answers have been no, Steve, and it's quite shockingly on some instances, they had no idea, right? I know that once Congress passed the bill, as is with every bill, they turn and they move to the next thing, and Lord knows our country has enough on its plate that the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is not even probably in the top 10 for most of them. And I respect that, and that's why I'm there to educate. But that's what we're doing now, and now there's an awareness from members. And some members, quite frankly, are very upset. And there are some members that are getting pounded now from their constituency. And I would also say from racetracks themselves, there has been a raising of awareness that this is not right. Again, unconstitutionality or logistics of programming and implementation, you know, there's a multitude of reasons that we need to take a check back and say, okay, if this is what we're going to do, Lord knows I need this industry to be around for a long, long period of time. And we've been operating without it. Now let's try to get it right. If this is the route we're going to go down, I think that's a very fair ask.
Eric, a couple of the other areas of interest and concern. Eric Hamelbeck with us from National HBPA to kind of bring a you know, full umbrella view of what we discussed yesterday with the five horsemen, four of which that were heavily invested and involved in Monday's presentation by Lisa Lazarus. And Eric, one thing that you actually voiced in the meeting on Monday, which is really an interesting discussion point. You know, we've dealt with the absolute insurer rule for horsemen, ultimately being, you know, where the buck stops for responsibility of the horse's care on the racetrack. You brought up the question about the chain of responsibility when a horse gets turned out and sent to a training center, sent to a rehab center, sent to a farm, you know, just for R&R, maybe over a winter, and who at that point is the covered person that is responsible? And it seems like a fascinating question, because there might be supervisory veterinarians that are not racetrack practitioners that are treating these horses. There's farm personnel that aren't covered persons. What's going to happen out there in the ether?
Yeah, that's a very I would use the term weeded problem, because, you know, when you really get down into the regulations and ask the horsemen that actually do this, maybe would have been good before the regulations were written. But there's a lot of new terminology that's new to people. The covered person, the covered horse, and the covered horse race, those are pretty commonplace now. But in the registration process, you have a designated owner. Okay, so if you're a covered person and you are registered as an owner, maybe you're the designated owner. What does that mean? You're the point man for the owner of the horse. i.e. multiple owner horses will have to designate a person. The other key phrase, and the one that got into this conversation, is the responsible person. Now, a horse at the racetrack in training, I'm going to say 99.9% of the time, the responsible person is the trainer, right? It's under his care, similar to what we have now, as you mentioned, the absolute insurer rule. Anything that happens to that horse, that trainer is liable. Well, that's a little dodgy right now, because the example that I've painted on multiple occasions is if my good friend and mentor Bobby Barnett is at Churchill and he has a horse that ships over to, let's say, a clinic in Lexington, Rude and Riddle, to take a chip out of an ankle. Whatever happens at that clinic, if Mr. Barnett is listed as a responsible person, he is responsible for making sure that any information is then uploaded into the authority's database. Well, that is almost egregious from the standpoint of trainers got enough going on with what's inside their shed row. And there won't be an easy way to document what happens at that track. I'm sorry, what happens at that clinic. So I suggested, in the interest and certainly the best interest of the trainer that's listed as a responsible person, you need to remove yourself from the responsible person category as soon as that horse leaves your barn. Now, the problem that we're seeing is changing the responsible person, again, a logistics issue, hasn't been an easy thing to do. We've seen it already, and nothing's even happened. We've had owners that have registered all of their horses, and then they try to change the responsible person after the fact, and they're unable to do it. They're unable to do it because nobody has communicated that, oh, well, that person's going to get an email, and you have to then accept it, and then there's this back and forth between who becomes the responsible person. You know, this may sound like complete hieroglyphics to a lot of folks out there, but that's the weeds of what we're getting into now, because, again, horsemen are now seeing what's going on, in many cases, for the first time. And we're the ones that are getting regulated, and those with the boots on the ground had no input when these things were going into place, other than the opportunity to comment. I'm not going to take that away from anyone. But you find me a trainer on the backside of any racetrack that's training multiple head of horses that's going to be focused on that. You know, and we tried to get the information out there. We certainly try to speak for our members. But that's extremely difficult when, you know, you have the expertise of who's being regulated, not getting a chance to input into the regulations. So it's again, as I said first, it's a weeded issue, but it's a real issue. And so the owner ultimately should be the responsible person because, as you mentioned, Steve, the veterinarians that are at the clinic, I would say most of the time, if not a high percentage of the time, they're not going to be practicing on the racetrack. They're not licensed by the State Racing Commission. They're not a covered veterinarian. Hopefully, your attending veterinarian is paying attention, but then all of a sudden, you've got an attending veterinarian who's supposed to upload that information. Well, what about the rest of his clients? We know now that veterinarians have to input their daily log and treatment sheets every day. Every day. They have to upload it to the authority. I mean, that's a logistical nightmare in and of itself. So, you know, the definition of the responsible person has become very important, and that's one thing that I'm trying to hammer home. If you register and you have horses in your care and you're listed as a responsible person, you have got to get your name removed if that horse leaves your barn. So,
do we know?
The situation comes up in claiming. Sorry, go ahead, Steve.
No, I just was going to follow that up by asking, and this is actually a kind of a dual question because I brought it up yesterday with the horseman. You know, the difficulty of having an expectation that every horseman is going to be able to read and interpret. And this is why Lisa Lazarus's answer to Michelle Lovell was just shockingly tone deaf and insulting. To say to Michelle, "Oh, I'm sorry that you're just finding out about these rules. The rules have changed repeatedly." And I mean, lawyers like Alan Foreman have been just exasperated by trying to find and follow the iterations. So to expect that horsemen have read these reams and reams of rules and have immediate comprehension of what every machination is going to entail is just preposterous. And the fact that they haven't had even an interest in trying to create executive summaries that help the horsemen and will help the horsemen explain things to owners, I mean, is just shocking, actually, how the expectation of this. And as I said yesterday, Eric, I think with Ron, the fact that it's almost like a bludgeoning of owners and the horsemen because we didn't sign on fast enough to their Lasix demands. And the fact right. that this thing has been just absolutely, you know, this monolith is being used to you know, take over the control, which, you know, which you and Alan and me and so many others have said for years was the desire from the get-go. But because the implementation of a Lasix elimination, that this has been, you know, what has been delivered upon us. It's just unbelievable. And you know, the way in which the dictation of it is, I'm just amazing to me that nobody would recognize on their end that they need to be helping the horsemen so that the horsemen can turn around and deal with the owners and get everybody on board. I mean it's just such an adversarial positioning the way that they've come into this.
Yeah, I totally agree. The point we go back to from the very beginning, poor communication. Certainly, you raise a point that was very concerning to me when the comment period was going on about the safety regulations. You know, there were new PDFs posted quite frequently without any red line. So if you had gone through a version And all of a sudden you recognize in the property line that it's a new version. You didn't know where the changes were. And yeah, that, and so that's me, right, who's sitting at a desk having the opportunity to do it. I'm not a trainer in a shed row that's taking care of multiple horses and staff. So you're right. To follow those was almost impossible for those like Alan and I, who that's our job. But then to kind of throw it back in the face of the people who are working every day, who are going to end up paying for all this, that you should have followed along on the computer. I mean, it was brought up in the Monday meeting. We honestly have trainers and owners out there that don't answer emails, that don't spend any time online. And we're still trying to figure out how to even get those folks registered if that's what they choose to do. We have affiliates that are offering to come into the HPPA offices, and if they choose to register, we'll help them because they don't have any other way to get it done. One of the best questions that I think have come out, and this is how something so simple can be so brilliant, Steve Asmussen's crew asked me to try to find out if in the authority's development of a budgeting, they will look into getting Wi-Fi on the backside. I mean, how brilliant is that? I mean, that in and of itself is, you know, most racetracks don't have that ability, and, you know, you're not in a place long enough to have it hardwired most of the time. You know, and again, that's something that I think, again, when you really look at trying to get everything rolled out, you know, a delay for people to really weigh in on a granular level. And I know that's hard. I've seen these meetings, and I've been on, you know, gosh, now I don't know how many of these town hall meetings. Some of the questions are getting answered differently from staff members from the authority. And again, they haven't been brought up to speed. It's like right now, we know Mark Guilfoyle's working for the authority. You know, he's got to get up to speed. And we're only a few days out, and you're going to put him in charge of being the liaison between the commissions. So, you know, there's a lot of things point back to my ask, and that's look at very strongly a delay. It's a very simple, what we call technical corrections bill, and let's move the program effective date. Our suggestion is January 1st of 2024. Because we have also been very vocal about the fact that from a logistics standpoint, starting in the middle of the summer, right, when the vast majority of racing is going on, you've got on June 30th a set of rules, and on July 1st, you've got another set of rules and or additional interpretations of a rule that's been preempted. You know, that doesn't make a lot of sense, at least if you're going into it at the beginning of the year, when there's fewer racetracks running, horses change age, it just makes more logistical sense. So that's why we would certainly recommend or certainly appreciate a delay of any amount of time for the industry. But if you're looking overall what's best for the industry and our interpretation, maybe January 1st of 2024 isn't that far away.
Well, and one other area here that we didn't even touch on and didn't even come up yesterday, you know, the situation in Texas, and you know, the fact that they're going to suspend paramutual, you know, interstate paramutual wagering on the product, which, you know, is. You know, the potential to impact handle and revenue for, you know, immediately for Lone Star, obviously, and there's so many parts of this that you know, as these presentations you know, come forward, and you know, there's others that are just going to manifest themselves you know, without even having thought about, there's going to be areas that come into question undoubtedly.
Absolutely. You know, we all look at, you know, that catchphrase, unintended consequences. There are still things that are going to occur that we have no idea it's going to happen until things get implemented. So if we can't even get the registration done smoothly right now, I think that's a telltale that we need to delay this thing. You know, and what Texas has done, I visited with, I still call her General Cook, you know, in December of last year when she was first hired, really brought her up to speed in a very quick way, along with my friend Joe Lucas in Oklahoma, and really just educated her on what the process was and what was coming. Obviously, she latched onto the bit and she's running through it. But our executive committee meeting in April of 2021, I rolled out that this interpretation was there. I said, it certainly appears to me, although I'm not a legal mind, that the HISA regulations will not govern you if you don't export your signal. And there's been a lot of talk about how that the act itself is interpreted, and you have to really look at the definition of a covered horse race to find your own interpretation. But I challenge people to do a cost comparison. You know, if it costs you X amount of percentage to increase to get to HISA compliant, or you have X amount of percentage going back into handle from your export signal, if there's a disparity there, maybe that's something to look at. So that's been a message of mine for quite some time to look at. Certainly don't advocate anything. I'm here to educate, and I give people options that are my members. Texas is going to be fine. When you look at the legislation that they passed, all the money that's being put into their purses, any of the Texas horsemen that are ridiculing right now on social media, I'm going to tell you that from the outside looking in, you're going to be okay. Let this kind of shake out, because I don't think you're going to see the negative of what people think is going to happen based off what the commission is doing. I think they're drawing a line in the sand, but they're also, I appreciate helping with the message of delay this, because, you know, this is what's happening. If we're going to do it, let's do it right. And here's our ask.
Eric Hamelbeck, Eric the Tiger on Twitter, of course. And Eric, I appreciate this, and a perfect follow-up to what we discussed yesterday. And I actually get to go on vacation when the clock strikes midnight. I'll be gone, so I'll come back. You know, this could be like Planet of the Apes, and I'm going to come back, and there's going to be this whole new world on July 7th when we come back from vacation. So we'll see. But I know you're at one thing I haven't mentioned going on today. Of course, we do have the Welfare and Safety Summit, the Welfare and Safety of the Racehorse Summit. It's at Keeneland, which is why you're there, and it all gets videotaped. And of course, this is actually is one of the great success stories in the game over the last 15 years, is the Welfare Summit, which all came out originally because of the aqueduct. Spate of injuries, and the things that this has produced have been just outstanding, including the injury database is an outgrowth of this, and many, many other initiatives. I'm always one that enjoys beating the drum for the successes that the industry basically can honestly put up as examples of answering critics and answering incidents and responding appropriately, and certainly the Racehorse Summit in so many different areas, aftercare a lot of the things that Alan Foreman talks about, the Mid-Atlantic program, and so many other things, this all over these last 15 years. So take that in. The video will show up soon enough on the Grayson Jockey Club Research Foundation portal on YouTube. In fact, it's on live. You can watch it today. But Eric, this was great. I appreciate it. Eric Hamelbeck, everybody. Let's take the break. We got 20 minutes into this third hour, actually, and we've got about 40 left. Seth Merrow, Chris Hyde, and Todd Pletcher. Once again, we've got more to do than time may allow, so we'll do the best we can. Back after a break, though, hour three at the races.
Thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with rope. Who are you betting on? How about an